Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Decibel Geek Podcast with Chris Sinzak and Aaron Camaro. This is Decibel Geek, and we are here to let the podcast do the talking. My name is Aaron Camaro, joined as always by my main man right there, Chris Sinzak. What's going on, my brother?
Not much. What's happening?
Oh, man. Well, we put on the Facebook, we attempted to record an episode at a convention where we're going to ask people what they bought, but that didn't really work out.
Yeah.
So we came back with a different idea, and that's why we're doing what we're doing today.
Yeah, we haven't done an episode on a single band in a while, and we'd like doing these top five shows. And they're not... preface this, but they're not exactly top five in order, but these are probably my five favorite songs of the era we're talking about.
Yes, mine too. I don't know if I'd put them in any particular order, but we're just going to go top to bottom. We're going to start at the beginning of the 80s and roll right on up to the edge of the 90s, and we're going to cover everything Aerosmith in between.
Yeah.
So it should be a lot of fun. So before we get to all that, you know us. We're going to do it, taking care of that business. And what's our business? You know that too. It's Apple Podcast reviews. We like Podchaser reviews. And we like Facebook recommendations. Let's see, what do we got today?
We got one of those.
Oh, we got one? Okay, well, one's better than none.
Yeah.
It's all five stars. We'll definitely take that. It's entitled Keeping Rock Alive. It goes a little something like this. I'm a kid again, listening to Babylon AD and Dangerous Toys while playing Dungeons & Dragons in my friend's basement. There's plenty of great nostalgia here, but also plenty of opportunity to be turned on to something new. Thanks, guys. And again, that comes to us from Strange Dunn, right here in the United States. Love it. That's great. I'm glad to see reviews like that, because it shows that there's so many people out there that are like-minded as we are when it comes to this kind of stuff.
Did you play D&D?
You know, I played one time with my friends. I had friends that played D&D, and it always looked so cool. And I loved the artwork and the books, and it sounded like so much fun. And then one time I said, okay, I'll play it with you. And so I sat down, and we did all this work creating a character for myself, and it was so much fun to create this dude,
Right.
And then we get in, and I open up a treasure box, and something comes out and kills me.
And you're like, never again.
Yeah, so I spent all this time building this guy. That's what I said. You're telling me we spent these hours to make this guy for me to walk in and open a treasure chest and die? And that's the end of my campaign? You guys get to keep playing and I'm out?
Yeah.
Forget this.
My brother was really big into it. Him and his friends would play it, and I'd always mock the shit out of them for it. And I was a younger brother, but I would mock the shit out of them for it. I'd be like, when are the girls going to come? Oh, never mind. I was an asshole.
That's funny.
But
I always loved the imagery. I always loved the artwork involved in Dungeons & Dragons. And it was created in Wisconsin. So there's that.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep.
But yeah, that's a cool review. I think that's the first Dungeons & Dragons reference we've ever had in a review. So I like that.
Other than talking about Dio lyrics.
Well, yeah. Yeah, that's Dungeons & Dragons metal.
That's right. I like that, too.
Awesome. So our other favorite people, the Geeks of the Week, these are the people that shared on Facebook or retweeted on Twitter last week's Fresh Blood episode.
It's always good to bring the fresh blood, because we like to prove that rock and roll is alive and well in the modern day.
And we had a lot of great feedback on that, so we really appreciate it that you guys like those bands, and make sure you go out and buy some stuff from those bands and... like their Facebook page, follow them on social media, go to a concert, get a t-shirt, all that good stuff.
Yes.
Because That's the only way they're going to make it these days.
Go to their Facebook pages and like them and tell them you heard it on Decibel Geek. And like Chris said, go pick up the album.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're doing it on Amazon, iTunes, whatever, you know, Apple Music, whatever it is nowadays. Getting the hard copies, just like me. Oh, man, I got three brand new albums sitting right here on the table next to me that came out in 2019. Not only am I enjoying the music, I'm feeling good about doing my part to keep these bands alive.
Yep. All right, Geeks of the Week this week are Eric Luzier, Darren Parkin, Ray Kuhn, Tom Cullen, Joseph Capone, Christopher Stokes, Scott Crouch, James Nicholson, Andrew Jacobs, Dave Shirt, James West, Thorbjorn Olson, Ken J. West, Brian Knapp, Shay Hargett, Christian Schimbeck,
yes,
Mike Parnell, Jeffrey Mendenhall, Adam Cox, I remembered you this time, and you, Mighty K, Shane Hebert, Simon Catt, Mikhail Burrell, Alan Tate, David Glenn, Warren Edward LaRue Baker, The Bakery Podcast, Aaron Baker, it's a whole lot of bakers, Trevor McDougall, CGCM Podcast, Rob Harris, Jeff Taylor, Jay Shabluski, J.J. Mack, Bill Elam, Jeff Mendenhall, Eladio, Vet Halen, Alan DeShawn, and as always,
the Mooger Fooger. That's right. I always got to double check now and make sure you got Mighty K's name in there.
I know.
She's going to look and say, if it's not there, I'm sure she shared it.
We're going to hear about it if it's not there. She's going to be like the Mooger Fooger. Even if she doesn't share it, I'm going to put her name on there.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're not getting your name read and you're sharing these episodes, contact Chris Sinzak at Decibel Geek.
Thanks. Appreciate the vote of confidence there.
He's in charge of the Geeks of the Week.
Yeah. It's all me. Oh, man.
Nice. So, you ready to go back in our time machine
yeah.
to 1980?
Yeah. So, what was Aerosmith up to in 1980?
Well, I think if we're talking about Aerosmith in the 80s, the thing to remember is in like a lamb and out like a lion.
That's pretty well stated.
When it comes to their success, the money they're making, the accolades, and all that good stuff. Because by the end of the 70s, Aerosmith is in pretty rough shape.
Mm.
You know, they barely get through making the Night in the Ruts album.
My favorite record of theirs.
Which is pretty damn great album. It's the angst, I think.
Yeah, a lot of drama in that, in the making of that one.
The band's just not what they were before. I mean, in the 70s, Aerosmith ruled the world. I mean, they were one of the top rock bands throughout the entire decade. But just like a lot of the bands of the 70s, come the end of the 70s and into the 80s is a tough transition. And Aerosmith's no different.
Yeah, and I mean, in 1980, Steven Tyler at one point, you know, passed out on stage from his drug use. And like his drug dependency had kind of reached its all-time high. And Perry was out of the band by this point, right? Because he had left the band by that point.
Right, because in 1979, they did the Super Bowl of Rock show in Cleveland.
It was World Series.
Was it World Series?
Yeah, World Series of Rock.
And it was the legend that the wives were fighting backstage. And
Stephen and Joe.
Stephen, well, no, it was Tom Hamilton and Joe Perry's wives.
I don't think I know this story.
They got into a huge fight backstage, and Joe Perry's wife throws milk on Hamilton's wife.
Hmm.
And it gets into a screaming, throwing shit, freak out thing. And then Joe and Steven weren't even there. So they come walking in on it and have no idea what's going on. And they just said it was basically just kind of a taking what the band was at that point and tuning it down to a moment.
Yeah.
And it was nonstop that all the time. Mm. You know, so there's fighting and bickering and talking shit to each other and just being stoned out of their gourds and, you know, just fucked up all the time. You know, they're Aerosmith, they can do whatever they want to, and something was bound to give.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's a huge blow up in Cleveland, and Joe Perry says, screw this, I'm out of here, and goes on to form the Joe Perry Project.
I remember, I read the Walk This Way book. I still have it, but it's been a
great book.
It's been probably close to 10 years since I've read it.
Yeah, me too.
But that period of time, the conflict and drama between Perry and Tyler alone is strange. Like it's higher, it's at an amplified level above other bands. And it's kind of a miracle that they're still doing it today, because it's almost one of those things where they love each other so much they hate each other. It's like,
I see that.
I know some people even were theorizing that they were kind of in love with each other. Like it's a weird thing to think, but like they became just dependent upon each other.
For sure. You know, when you've got a creative partner like that, I got to think, you know, it becomes like a need sort of thing.
Yeah.
And we're going to explore some of this coming up in this episode, but, you know, to be apart, it hurt them both.
Yeah.
You know, you could tell because when they got back together, it was such a big deal for them to get back together. So, you know, you got a creative partner like that, you're creating great things that people just love. And then you split apart and you don't get that adoration as much. You got to wonder, you know, are we really connected that way? Can we only create the magic together? Are we that codependent that even creatively and artistically we need each other too?
Well, I think for that level, sure. I mean, there's good stuff on Joe Perry Project records, but...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Although we've heard Steven Tyler's solo record, not so much.
The country one that came out?
Yeah.
I didn't even listen to it.
Yeah.
I don't want to.
It doesn't work. To me, it doesn't work.
Well, thank goodness we don't have to talk about that today.
Yeah, no. But yeah, so, I mean, you know, he was... 80 was, you know, and yes, I am looking through Wikipedia, but I'm not going to read directly off of it. It looks like in fall of 80, Steven Tyler had and I remember reading about this in the book, a serious motorcycle accident.
Yeah, that puts him on his ass and puts Aerosmith on their ass for pretty much the entire year.
Yeah, so not a good start to the decade for them.
No, So 1980, done. It's nothing kind of to talk about. Yeah.
Then 81 comes around and they, what's left of Aerosmith goes in to the studio to reunite with Jack Douglas to work on what would become Rockin' a Hard Place.
Which, you know, I think is a pretty underrated album at the time and even now. You know, there's some great songs on this album. I was putting these songs in some sort of order at first, and I thought, man, it's so hard to put them in order, but I think this is easily my number one favorite Aerosmith song of this era. Mm-hmm. And it's the lead-off track off of Rockin' a Hard Place, a good hard rocking tune that just harkens back to what you love about the classic Aerosmith of the 70s. This is no different, so you're going to love this. I love it a lot. It's a tune called Jailbait. Now that's what I like about Aerosmith.
Yeah,
right there.
I love that song. Always have. But yeah, it's this album is unfairly, you know, criticized in my opinion. I've always liked it.
Yeah,
I think it holds up well with a lot of what they've done in the past. There's some stuff that kind of, I mean, it's got its weak moments for sure. I mean, the prelude to Joni and Joni's Butterfly, yeah, it's a little odd.
Nah, I don't care for.
There's
that.
Pieces of Joni's Butterfly that are great, but that's one of those songs where that's a drug song because. It goes on forever, and there's parts they should have just chopped out of it and made it into a song.
Maybe that.
Instead, they were chopping other stuff. But yeah, and also, you know, Brad Whitford really is only on one track on this album, and,
right? Because it's about that time where he splits off to do Whitford St. Holmes.
So really,
which is awesome too.
And Rick Dufay didn't like join up until they started touring. So it's really the Jimmy Crespo show for the guitar parts.
Yeah.
So he must have just done double duty on the guitar part.
I don't know too much about Jimmy Crespo. I know he was in a band called The Flame before Aerosmith, but I don't really know a lot about
I pretty
about
much
them
just
either.
Know him for the Aerosmith years. Right. But
I mean, he was a hell of a fill-in for Joe Perry because this album's really pretty good. I mean, out of this whole thing, I mean, there's six really solid songs on the album.
I agree.
For sure.
I wanted to pick one song off this record to go with, and this song could have been comfortably on Toys in the Attic, in my opinion. I think it's got the same vibe and spirit, so which is a good tribute to Jimmy Crespo for pulling it off. This is Bolivian Ragamuffin.
That's another one of the songs I appreciate a lot off of that album.
Pretty energetic.
Yeah, I dig it. That's a good classic Aerosmith right there.
It's a cocaine tune.
I guess for me, I don't know, I like the weird parts sometimes, but the early part of the 80s Aerosmith to me, I like better than the later part. So I've actually got another song off of Rock and a Hard Place, which, like I said, there's six strong songs on here, and I could have went with any one of them. But this was the single. I mean, it didn't get much play, but it's a great song. This one's really cool. I dig it a lot. I love the riff. It's got that, it's got something to it. I dig it a lot. A little different than what you're used to with Aerosmith, but it's a tune called Lightning Strikes.
Great one. And the video is pretty funny. Have you seen the video?
No.
Oh, they're all like, they've got like their hair slicked back and they're wearing leather jackets, like the 50s greaser look.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, look like they're in a gang and they've got like pipes and stuff that they're going to beat people up with.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a cheesy fucking video.
So that probably didn't help their case.
No.
When people see that and go, Aerosmith looks like this now?
And Steven looked really bad, like super gaunt. Like you could tell it was like, it's similar to how Alice Cooper looked around the same time, where it's like, you know, okay, your diet consists of drugs and alcohol only.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, they just looked like he could blow away at any moment.
Well, I think that was part of the problem with Joe Perry, was when they were working on Night in the Ruts, the whole album was done. Like, it was completely completed. And Steven Tyler couldn't come up with no words for it. They couldn't place the vocals to it. And so Joe Perry's like, well, what am I waiting on? That was a big part of the catalyst that made him leave. So, I mean, that's many years, though, in a row that we're up to almost 83, 84 now. And it's just been nonstop for Steven Tyler.
It's a miracle he lived through this period.
Yeah, I'd say.
And, you know, at a show in Massachusetts, you know, him and Joe got, they reunited backstage and got high before the show.
That's funny.
And then Steven collapses on stage and couldn't get up.
But that was where the good feelings started again, where it kind of planted the seeds for Aerosmith to reunite. And that's funny, though, you know. So they can't get along. They can't get along unless they're doing drugs together.
Then it's all great.
As long as the wives aren't around and we've got some drugs, we can be best friends.
Well, and they were, you know, and now starting with Night in the Ruts, but also on this tour, you know, they're playing like little theaters and some club shows.
Yeah, it's not the same.
Like, they're not doing well at all.
Well, and then Aerosmith has got to be looking at it as, wow, you know, Joe Perry really did mean that much to this band. Brad Whitford, the whole, you know.
And he's off doing Whitford St. Holmes at that point.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, to go from what they were in the 70s to playing clubs and shit and barely being able to fill those.
It's a big fall from grace.
Man, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
I mean, Kiss didn't even play clubs.
They got close. They probably should have been playing clubs. I think it was pride that kept them from doing it.
Yeah.
But Aerosmith was pretty much DOA at that point.
For sure.
It's, you know, I didn't get into Aerosmith until right before Permanent Vacation. I got into him through the stupid video with Run DMC.
Yeah.
I mean, that, which is the way a lot of people my age got into him at that point. But
that was the introduction for sure.
But yeah, so I had no idea about any of this stuff until much later after the fact. So, like, you know, like our people that remember this period of time, like, you know, Ralph from Rock and Metal Combat, you know, they talk about seeing them at this point and what, still great on some songs, but at the same time, like, you never knew what was going to happen from moment to moment.
Right. And as soon as Steven Tyler hits the floor, it's over.
Yeah, it's like he was just a mess through the whole period. But yeah, it's crazy that he didn't OD during this time. I mean, it must have been awful. And the whole band, I guess, wasn't getting along at this point either.
No, and it's just like same old thing. You know, when you're riding high, everybody can tolerate each other. When times are tough, it's like, what am I doing here?
Yeah.
And it's not like the Joe Perry Project was playing stadiums either.
No. So, no, they were playing even smaller places, you know.
So to get together and do a little toot and reminisce on old times, that's going to lead to some good things. That's going to lead to Done with Mirrors.
Yeah, that's in 1984.
It's probably one of the best Aerosmith albums that nobody ever talks about.
Yeah, in 84, Joe saw Aerosmith perform at the Orpheum in Boston.
I think it said him and Whitford were, him and Whitford were there together. They both went.
Oh, were they?
And they all got back together backstage.
And I guess it was inevitable that it was going to happen. They all kind of needed each other. Because, well, like,
clearly.
I mean, Whitford St. Holmes was great too, but that wasn't selling tons of copies either. So they did the Back in the Saddle tour to give it a shot again to see how the chemistry. This is before Done with Mirrors. It was well attended, but a lot of incidents, a lot of drug use. You know, drug use still was an issue. Geffen Records took a shot at him and gave him a contract.
And I think that at this point they're starting to get back up there again. They're out of the clubs and now they're playing a little bit bigger venues. They're gathering more of a crowd again now.
Yeah. And then in 85 they put Done with Mirrors out. It did get some positive reviews, but at the same time it was funny they were getting trashed by a lot of critics for sounding too much like Aerosmith.
And that sucks. Yeah, I read some of those reviews when I was looking at this, thinking,
well, what do you want them to sound like?
It's a freaking awesome album. It really is. It's one of my favorites, you know. It's one of my favorites out of the whole entire catalog. There's not a single song on this album that I don't like.
I don't remember liking it as much as I do now. Like, I don't know that I gave it as much attention as it should have gotten back when I was because we're
real young, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when I got into Aerosmith, it just got kind of overlooked. But I've tried listening to it over the years, and it never really stuck. But I really, you know, took a good run through it today, and I was like, damn, this album's actually really good.
It's really good.
The production's not super great on it, and that's Tom Werman's doing. Which Tom Werman always seems to have big, you know, this one wasn't a hit, but he'd have big hit albums with bands like Motley Crue, Cheap Trick, but there's always something just a little off with the production for rock fans, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, it's it's almost like a little bit too tinny sounding. Like there's not a lot of balls to some of the stuff he does.
Yeah.
He did open up and say, "I'm out for poison."
Right. Yeah.
And that sounds a little too sterile compared to look what the cat dragged in.
True.
Yeah. You know, it doesn't have the punch. Punch is the right word. It's lacking punch.
It's too bad.
But there's good songs on this record.
Really good songs. I picked two of them off here. This one's another one that's, oh man, this might be, and I could say that for any one of these, but this might be my favorite song from this era. This song has got such an awesome groove to it. And crank this one up, kick back, enjoy. This one's called Darkness.
A unique song.
I know they it's way different. Yeah, but it's so cool.
They kind of they veer off in different directions in that song, but that's what I like about it, though.
I like it a lot too.
Yeah,
I always think about remember that time we did the Kiss What If episode?
Yeah,
what if Done With Mirrors would have been the big comeback album instead of the one that's coming next? What if this was the one that would have brought Aerosmith back up? What kind of a ripple effect would that have on the rest of rock and roll? Because you look at we're going to cover it too. We're going to cover Pump, and we're also going to talk about Permanent Vacation. Which are totally different than this album.
Yeah.
When Permanent Vacation comes out and it's huge, that changes the whole projectile.
Yeah, because a lot of people play Follow the Leader. A lot of bands tried to do what they did.
Yes. Yeah. But if this album would have been the huge one, it would have changed the entire history of rock and roll music.
It would have had an effect because, you would have had, as we'll get into it, once Permanent Vacation hit and then Pump, I mean, they went for a way more commercial sound. You bring on a lot more co-songwriters.
Yes, this was the last album with no co-writes.
Yeah, this is all Aerosmith.
This is the band. Yeah. This is them. That's what I like about it.
So, yeah, and co-writes became the standard at that point, you know. So, just like with Motley Crue, Aerosmith and Motley Crue, I'd say, were probably the two most trailblazing bands of the 80s for rock music.
Right. And they were right along the same wavelength all the way through.
Yeah. And, like, everybody played Follow the Leader with whatever they did. That's what everybody wanted to do. Bon Jovi, too, of course. You have to give them credit. But, yeah, it could have been a lot different. But, yeah, I mean, you picked that one. It's funny. I don't think Done with Mirrors is my favorite album of this period. I think, honestly, Rockin' a Hard Place is my favorite album as a whole.
Really?
But
see, I'll take this one as a whole over any
I like them both. But it's funny, though. Rockin' a Hard Place is the one I would listen to from start to finish first. But I picked two off Done with Mirrors and two off Pump, so I don't know what the hell I'm doing.
I don't know either.
It's weird, isn't it?
I'm okay with it because I love this album. The more we play off it, the better.
So for my first pick for this one, this song is unique too, and this is one where they kind of actually do sound a little bit like they're – it sounds more like an 80s song, but they pull it off, and it's a underrated gem in this catalog, and it's a song called The Reason a Dog.
Older sister, she's a lot like you. She likes to grab my
yeah, I love that one too.
It's a
whole album, I'm telling you.
It's a great song.
Everybody, do yourselves a favor. If you don't know this one, if you're not familiar with the album Done With Mirrors, get out there and get yourself a copy of it. I promise there's not a bad song on it. Here's proof. This is our third one in a row off that album. This is another one I love. This one actually transcends all eras of Aerosmith for me because this is one of my favorite songs by them of all time. This is a tune called My Fist, Your Face. Song kick somebody's ass to.
Yeah.
I like that it. One. Ruthless Aggression.
Yeah.
From Aerosmith.
Great song. I almost picked, was it Shame on You?
That's a great song too.
I almost picked that again because that has the old school vibe to it. Sounds like something out of the 70s. But I do like that one. But this song,
Sheila, Gypsy Boots, She's on Fire, The Hop. It's all good.
Gypsy Boots has an amazing lead part on it.
Yeah. This whole album is killer. By doing this, it reintroduced me to how much I love this album, because out of all four of these albums, I haven't really gone back to these in quite a while, and that was when you brought it up. I thought, oh man, I gotta listen to Pumped. Oh man, I gotta listen to Permanent Vacation, and well, what about Done With Mirrors? I know that's pretty good. I'm gonna listen to that, and I was like, man, I forgot how good this is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So out of all these albums as a whole, if I had to only choose one, I would definitely go with Done With Mirrors.
It's a lot better than I remember. Like I said, it's one of those where I didn't think I was going to pick but maybe one. But and this is the one that I'm going to play next. This one, when I think of favorite Aerosmith songs of the 80s, this one probably came to mind first. And it's not really an Aerosmith song. It's actually a Joe Perry Project song,
because
it was initially on his first record. But I will take the Aerosmith version over that version any day, because give me Tyler's vocals and his altered lyrics, and I'll do this one. This is Let the Music Do the Talking.
When Joe Perry left, he's like, well, I'm taking this shit with me.
And I think that one, you know, I know it was released as a single, but it's one of those where it was the right choice for a single, even though it didn't do that great. I think it could have been a hit. It's catchy enough. But just probably not the right time for that.
Yeah, around that time, Joe Perry said in a Rolling Stone interview, "I know everybody's going to ask if we got back together for the money. And of course we did. No, it's fun to have the money come in, but the reason is definitely the pleasure we get from playing together again."
Yeah.
And I mean, all the things I read about, you know, from that era, it seemed pretty legit. You know, they were all really happy to be back together. They were really happy to be out of the clubs.
Yeah.
But it's only going to keep going up. The roller coaster is on its way. But there's one thing standing in the way of Aerosmith reaching the full potential of success, to become once again one of the biggest bands in rock. And we talked about it this whole episode so far, and it's lots and lots of drugs.
Yeah.
And it's all fucking things up for them and getting in the way of them reclaiming their thrones.
Yeah.
So they go through some big changes.
Well, before they go through those changes, though, they're still on drugs when they go back on the radar.
Right, for sure. Yeah.
Because of the collaboration with Run DMC.
Oh, yeah, you can't forget about that.
1986. It was just Tyler and Perry appearing on the track. But Run DMC were doing, I think it was maybe their producer that brought it to them, the song, to their attention, because they didn't know Walk This Way by Aerosmith. They didn't know it. And they thought the lyrics were fucking ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, they thought it was stupid. And they actually were insulted by it. And they were like, "We're not going to do this damn song." Honestly, though, if you think about Walk This Way, it's one of...
But I thought Run DMC had been using that for a long time as something that they had been doing in their shows.
Mm-mm.
Huh.
No, they were in the studio when I think it was their producer or their manager
said,
"Do something with this." And they heard the lyrics and they were horrified by it. They were like, "What the fuck is this?"
So was that something like, do Aerosmith a favor and help them out with this? Or this is the idea behind this?
It might have been
help Aerosmith.
I don't know, maybe it was Rick Rubin or somebody. It was somebody that brought
the... Was it Rick Rubin? Sure, yeah.
So he brought the song to their attention. And he must have just heard it in his head going, you know. Because, I mean, if you listen to Walk This Way, it is a rap song.
Yeah.
I mean, the way Steven does the lyrics, it's a rap song.
Yeah, it's delivered in that way.
So I can see why Rick Rubin would be like, "Oh, we could actually have a rap group do this song and see, and it would work." But Run DMC did not want to do it. They thought it was stupid.
Wow, I did not know that.
But then when they all got in the studio together and they started doing it, like, "Wow, this actually sounds really cool." So that's how it worked out. But I think I remember seeing Steven Tyler do an interview saying, like, he was in the studio with them and he would run out every 10 minutes to go, like, do more coke or heroin or whatever. Like, he was that bad off at the
time. I mean, that's really the kickoff right there, because that gets Aerosmith back on MTV.
Yeah.
You know, gets the video in regular rotation.
Number four on the Hot 100.
It helps rap in a huge way because it introduces rap to a whole new audience of listeners and music buyers. And it puts Aerosmith right back on everybody's radar. So now Aerosmith is officially back.
I was amazed by it when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Like when the MTV played the hell out of that video.
Yeah, they did.
And I remember watching it.
Because, again, I mean, it's in MTV's best interest to branch out, and this rap is starting to become pretty popular, so you better embrace it. And really, what better way to introduce it to suburban America than through a band everybody already knows?
Right.
Through a track that actually sounds pretty good mixed together.
Yeah, like I said, it's the way it's delivered on the original version. It's like a rap song already. So,
and it was perfect. It was
natural.
The time.
Yeah, Rick Rubin's a genius for coming up with that idea.
Yeah.
But
what if he'd have done it with Kiss?
I got no response for that. Although I guess
so many what ifs.
Although I guess Kiss did the rap rock thing with All Hell's Breaking Loose.
Yeah, that's the one. What if you'd have brought All Hell's Breaking Loose to him instead?
Who knows?
What could have been?
Steven Tyler is not the Breeze. But yeah, so that I remember seeing that video for the first time, and that was my introduction to Aerosmith.
Yeah,
was seeing that video.
I guess that would have been mine too. But I think around that same time, I also discovered the cassette tape of Aerosmith's Greatest Hits.
But if you remember when the video came out, if you didn't know who Aerosmith was, you still didn't know, because it didn't say Run DMC featuring Aerosmith.
No?
No, it just said Run DMC. Because I remember being a kid watching that video, and that video was on almost every hour,
so then
wondering who the hell the band was.
And then in that respect, it was a calculated move to elevate rap.
Yeah.
And not Aerosmith.
Yeah, it wasn't listed with Aerosmith's name.
If it was to help elevate Aerosmith, then their name would have definitely been
there. Their name was not on there, because
so
I remember
that was to help bring rap to the masses.
Sure.
Wow. And it worked.
Because I remember wondering who the rock band was and watching the video. And then when I saw the video for Dude Looks Like a Lady, I'm like, holy shit, that's the band that was on that rap video.
Aerosmith.
Yeah.
Huh.
That's how I figured out who it was.
Wow.
I didn't have any I wasn't buying rock magazines at that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, this is very literally right at the very beginning of me becoming a rock and roll fan.
That's wild.
It was when that video came out.
It could have went either way.
What was that video?
We're talking about Tupac right
now. Oh, boy. But yeah, it was that video and Come On, Feel the Noise by Quiet Riot. Yeah. Stuff like that. That right, We're Not Going to Take It by Twisted Sister.
Interesting you should bring up Quiet Riot. Right about this time, Joe Perry's quoted as saying, "The Quiet Riots and all those guys with the leather and the studs and the stacks of Marshall amps that aren't even turned on better watch out. We are the band your mother warned you about."
Wow. Well.
So they're back to take over.
Well, they took over right after that.
I kind of figured they paved the way.
So I'll let you start talking about Permanent Vacation because they get cleaned up.
Right. Yeah. So they go through all their problems and their manager comes to them and says, you know, if you guys would just stop doing drugs by 1990, I could have you as the biggest band in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow through the miracle of science, they were able to clean up Aerosmith.
Hard to believe.
That is the modern world we're living in.
Yeah.
If the human race as a whole can collectively come up with the science to remove the drugs from the system of Aerosmith, is there anything we can't do?
I don't know.
Is there any mountain we can't climb?
Well, they brought in Tim Collins to manage them. And
that must have been the guy.
He was kind of the guru that got them all on board to do rehab.
He wasn't lying.
No, because
by 1990, it's hard to argue that Aerosmith wasn't the biggest rock band in the world.
Easily. And
it all starts at this time.
From what I remember, he came in with kind of an iron fist and just said, listen, you saw what just happened with Run DMC. Look at the opportunity you have here. You can be the biggest band in the world, but you have to put the work in.
Right.
And you have to get clean. All of you. All at the same time.
And you have to write songs with Desmond Child.
Well, that was part of it, too. But then, I don't know, if you've read Walk This Way, though, it doesn't end well with Tim Collins, which, you know, that's way into the 90s. But Tim Collins, became kind of a control freak about every aspect of their lives. So, you know, being that way at first to get them off the drugs was smart. But right. Then years after they've been off drugs, he's still trying to drive the point home. And we're like, any little minor thing, oh, we have to have a meeting about this, you know, just... And I get it. They're the cash cow, too.
Yeah, that's to make sure you're still valuable and needed to be paid.
Yeah. So
job security.
They eventually kicked him to the curb because they're like, look, you've done enough. But yeah, I mean, you have to give the guy credit. I mean, he turned a band that was probably one of the worst druggy bands in history around. And it paid off in spades for everybody.
Big time. And so when they come back and they're all cleaned up, they go back into the studio to produce Permanent Vacation. This is the beginning of the end for the classic Aerosmith fan.
Sea change.
Yeah, for sure. Things are a lot different. Yeah, corporate Aerosmith, for sure.
Yeah.
But again, this was my Aerosmith album.
This was
the first one that I bought myself. Mm-hmm. If I bought it myself, somebody got it for me. I had it on LP when I was a kid.
Yeah.
Because I was trying to resist cassette tapes. It was like, I buy LPs. And then I just make dub cassette tapes, and then I don't ever have to worry about if they get wrecked. I can always make a new one.
That's true.
And so I was still buying LPs back then. God, I was a weird kid. And I had this one on LP, and, you know, I liked it then. But then after a while, I was like, I don't really like this era of Aerosmith anymore. It's too poppy, too slick. And I kind of got away from it. But this last week of listening to these four albums, kind of came back around on Aerosmith's Permanent Vacation a little bit because it's definitely a weird album. And of course, you got your big hits off of it, which everybody knows.
I still say, and I know I'm the ballad guy, Angel is a damn good power ballad. I mean, it's probably one of the most well-written power ballads ever.
Yeah, I don't know, man. This album's tough. There's songs on. Did you pick anything off here?
No.
You didn't pick anything?
This is my least favorite album from this era.
Wow.
And there's a lot of filler, in my opinion.
Okay, well, here's what I like about it. I like the title track, even though it's weird, kind of a Jimmy Buffett kind of a song.
It's weird, yeah.
I like the song Heart's Done Time.
I like how it starts, but then it just meanders forever. It's like an unfinished song to me.
It's got a good hook to it. I like it.
Most of it's good.
I like the song St. John.
No.
I think it's a weird song,
don't like
but it's
it.
Got some cool guitars to it. I dig that. Hangman Jury
sucks.
I like that song.
You like
too.
That song?
Yeah, well, it's got that weird kind of, you know, like Ozark Mountain Daredevil's chicken shucking kind of song.
That's why I don't like it.
Thing at the beginning. But then after it kicks in, it's pretty cool. Then yeah, I like it.
Not for me.
And the Beatles cover, I'm Down.
That's my, one of my least favorite Beatles songs, too.
Really?
Never liked I'm Down.
Well, I like the Beatles version.
And the movie? What the fuck is that?
I like the Aerosmith version. The movie? I don't know. I never seen that.
No, the last song, the movie.
Oh, I don't know about that.
It sucks.
That is weird, and I don't like
that. It's like we've run out of stuff to put on this record, so let's put this crap on here.
But there is one song on this album that I like, I think, a little bit better than the rest.
The one you picked is the one I like from this record.
And what strikes me about this is, you know, this album is full of co-writes with Desmond Child and Holly Knight.
Oh, yeah.
Who we know for what they did with Kiss, or Four Kiss, or Two Kiss. I don't know. Depends on what you like. I don't really like that stuff. I like the heavier hard rock and stuff. But this is a song that can't be denied. This one was written with Jim Vallance, who Kiss fans will know, and a million other bands fans will know, because he co-wrote so many great tunes over the years with so many different bands.
A great writer.
And he worked out this one with Steven Tyler and Joe Perry. And it's one of those songs where it almost could be done by anybody.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Tina Turner could have took this song and made it a good Tina Turner song. And, you know, Bryan Adams could have took this song and made it a great Bryan Adams song. And Paul Stanley could have included this song on Crazy Nights.
I was going to say,
and it would have been awesome.
I can hear a Kiss vibe on this song.
Totally. And that's what I think I like about it. The hook, the groove, all of it. It's really what you'd want if you were trying to come up with a great pop rock song.
Yeah.
It's very poppy, yes, but it's still got a good hard edge to it. It's Aerosmith taking a song that really could have been a top hit for anybody and definitely making it into an Aerosmith song. And I like it a lot. It's a tune called Magic Touch. that's my only selection off of Permanent Vacation.
If I was going to pick anything off that album, that would have been the one. Yeah, obviously, I like that one
better than the rest.
I mean, honestly, if I'm picking literally, and I'm not trying to ignore singles, Angel would have been on my top five. But I'm not going to play Angel because I know I'm going to get a bunch of tomatoes thrown at me digitally. And people are like, I've heard that song a million times. So right. That's why I didn't pick it.
That's the other hard thing about these last two albums out of the 80s with Aerosmith is, you know, for me, I looked at them in going into the next album, especially some of these songs, it's hard to judge them with a clean slate when you're listening to them and trying to listen to them anew.
Yeah.
Because I remember myself getting the feeling, same feeling I had with Van Halen back then, you know, when the videos would come on or the song would come on the radio, it just make me go, I miss the old band.
You know? I didn't go through that because I was just getting into these bands. Yeah. So
when Dude Looks Like a Lady started feeling overplayed, when Janie's Got a Gun was played till I just wanted to puke and Ragdoll. I didn't ever want to hear it. Ragdoll was everywhere. All these songs were huge.
Yeah.
And it just was like, man, Aerosmith's just not what they used to be, but everybody seems to love them now more than ever. And I couldn't understand it.
And one thing I'll mention that especially on the singles, they did this on singles all the way into the 90s, were those damn keyboard horns.
Yeah, I hate that. It's Ragdoll's full of them.
Ragdoll and Dude Looks Like a Lady.
Yeah, I don't like that.
I hate the sound of those. I didn't like the sound of them then.
That's what they are. They're sax offenders.
Exactly.
I don't like that. I can't abide by it.
I hope they're registered. Even back in those days when I was just a dumb kid, I didn't like it even then.
On my nerves so bad.
It ruins the song. It
totally does.
And like, Dude Looks Like a Lady is a clever song, written well. Yeah. Ragdoll is one of those that I think I tried to like it at the time just because it was big. But in hindsight, boy, that song sucks.
Do you know the story about that song?
Ragdoll?
When Steven Tyler wrote it, it was called Ragtime.
That makes more sense.
Holly Knight came in and said, you know, it would go a lot better with the rest of the song and it would fit better lyrically and be more aesthetically pleasing if it was called Ragdoll.
But it is a ragtime style
right.
vocal.
But with the change, that gives her credit for songwriting.
Oh yeah, she learned from Gene and Paul. She learned from Gene and Paul. No, that's smart on her part. I always liked their videos because they always had hot chicks in their videos. Yeah, Ragdoll had a lot of hot chicks in it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was after a while. That became the only good thing about Aerosmith videos.
Yeah, you knew you were going to have Alicia beautiful Silverstone women. Steven Tyler pimping his daughter out.
Yeah, Liv Tyler. Oh, I loved them videos back then.
Yeah,
just turned on the volume. We'll
save that for our '90s Aerosmith episode.
Oh God,
you know we'll have to do it eventually.
We'd have to do '90s and 2000s and do it all the way up to today because I don't think we could each pick five songs.
Yeah.
I don't even want to think about talking about Just Push Play or Music from Another Dimension or anything like that.
Mass amounts of unsubscribe.
We could do it. It would be painful for us.
But
for the people, we would do it.
I think Permanent Vacation is overrated. I would say it's
overrated.
Not at a great album.
It was everywhere.
Because of those singles.
Yeah.
But when you get outside the singles, there's not a lot there. Magic Touch is great, but
it's a weird album.
There's some strange stuff on this record. So let's
again, this is them doing all kinds of other people's songs and having other people lay such heavy influence on their writing when Steven Tyler and Joe Perry should just be doing it themselves. But that wasn't going to be successful, and this was. So what can you do? You know, this is better than no Aerosmith at all.
Well, I mean, I'm sure they don't look back negatively on those years. I mean, they made a lot of money. Yeah. You know, it was they've earned a whole lot of new fans from it. So, like, it's funny, you know, bands have been chasing the Aerosmith formula down for decades because I have to give them credit. Even though we may not like the material, 70s, big. 80s, comeback completely sounding different, big. Yeah. 90s, do it again. I mean, that's even crazier is that they got even fucking bigger in the 90s.
Oh, with, what was the song? The Armageddon song.
I don't want to miss a thing.
Massive.
And like.
Massively horrible.
I know, but
massive.
But like, from a marketing and business standpoint, you have to tip your hat to them.
Oh, for sure.
It's like, it's insane how
any band
well
that can survive through the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the 2000s, the 2010s, and still be around and relevant today.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, that, you know, although the last couple records, then nobody was paying attention.
Their fans were, and they still have plenty of fans.
They didn't sell well, though. Like, there wasn't much going on.
I don't think they probably put that much effort behind it either.
Well, that would help explain Music from Another Dimension.
That's what I'm saying.
Oh, that album sucks. I don't know any Aerosmith fan that liked that record.
No?
No, I don't. I'm sure they're out there, but nobody that I know liked it.
I
didn't like a single song on it.
No, me neither. And I wanted to.
There's like four or five ballads on the damn thing.
Really wanted to like it.
Yeah.
I thought it's supposed to feel cool that Aerosmith's coming out with a new album in this day and age. And
no.
Then you get it in hopes that it's going to be good, and it's just not.
Yeah.
This was the beginning of all that. You know, this was Aerosmith stop being Aerosmith and being what everybody else wanted him to be.
Yeah.
And that goes into the next album.
You sound so dejected.
I didn't pick anything off Pump.
Well, that's good, because I picked two songs off of it.
I knew you would.
Yeah, but I would.
That's why I left it.
I would argue that I picked the two songs you would like the most off of it.
I agree, yeah.
So,
because the rest of it totally sucks.
Oh, man. You're too hard.
I don't know. Let me see. What? Go ahead and pick one of your songs and let me look at this again and see if there's anything in here I like.
I think what I picked you'll like, but... All right, so Pump, it comes out September of 89, produced by Bruce Fairbairn. Of course, for our Kiss fans, they'll remember him from producing Psycho Circus. Bruce Fairbairn, probably not the greatest producer, but always got good sounds out of the instruments. I'll give him that. Every album that he's done sounds good. Over 7 million in sales to date for this record.
Yeah?
Yeah, a lot of sales. The singles are obviously still very well known to this day. I still love What It Takes and Love in an Elevator, at least musically. I think the lyrics on that one are kind of lame, but music, like I like Joey Kramer's drum part on Love in an Elevator.
Oh, yeah.
I'll get that specific.
Yeah, definitely.
His drum part is phenomenal.
And that goes without saying, I think. And you talk about Aerosmith, everybody always talks about Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, but the rest of the band is freaking awesome.
They're great musicians.
I love Brad Whitford.
Me too. And What It Takes is a great rock and roll ballad. I think that's one of the better ones from that era. And you can tell that, and it has a good vibe to it. But there's two songs on this record that I think stand out as some of their best work from this time and have a little bit of that old throwback sound. The first one is the album opener, Young Lust. Makes it sound more modern, but
right.
But as a song, I think they could have done that one back in the day. It's got the same vibe.
I remember when the video for The Other Side came out and how that was played constantly.
All the time.
And I think that was another part of, again, not really caring for this era of Aerosmith, is because it felt so forced upon me.
Yeah.
And The Other Side's not really a terrible song.
It's got those damn horns on it,
though. But it's, again, it's got, yeah, I mean, Lovin' and Elevator's got it, too. They all got it.
Yeah. They use it a lot. I think the two songs I picked are the two songs that don't have it.
I think that's it.
And obviously this album was fucking massive.
And I don't ever need to hear Janie's Got a Gun again.
No, that's one of the most overplayed songs of all time.
Uh-huh.
Has to be. I remember seeing...
Still is, to this day. I mean, that's still gets played. Songs.
Yeah. I remember seeing them on Saturday Night Live when this came out.
Yeah.
And
that's a sign of success right there.
Yeah.
If you are on Saturday Night Live. Yeah, because that would have been... Yeah, that would have been early 90s.
90, yeah.
But they were on Wayne's World.
Yeah.
They were...
with Tom Hanks, where Tom Hanks was playing the roadie.
That's right.
Yeah. Check one. Sibilance. Wayne's World, something else that hasn't aged well. Comes off really corny when you watch it now. It
just reminds me of us, kind of.
don't say that.
Podcasters in general?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it is very similar to Wayne's World.
Yeah.
But
I like Wayne's World.
But I remember their live performance on SNL. They did Janie's Got a Gun, which is like, we were all kind of sick of that. And then they did, was it Monkey on My Back was the other song? It was like a B-side.
Yeah.
And it wasn't very good either. But they just, I don't know, man. They're
playing other people's songs.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much what it boils down to. And
they're like a country band now.
Well, almost like a pop star,
yeah.
You know, because pop stars typically have stuff written for them. And Steven Tyler and Joe Perry, they had an image. Like, they fit like a glove to the hair band era.
They were older,
but they could still pull off the look.
Because they inspired it.
They inspired it.
Yeah.
So
Aerosmith and Van Halen probably have more responsibility for the Sunset Strip 80s glam movement than any other bands. Kiss a little bit, yeah.
A little, but yeah.
But not as
more
much
of
those
bands.
Two bands, especially Aerosmith.
Yeah, Aerosmith and Van Halen, you could probably credit them with the bulk of that. But yeah, I mean, they were fucking everywhere. I mean, I got sick of Aerosmith a little bit during this time.
Yeah, me too.
And
it would only get
already.
Worse coming into the 90s.
Yeah, and then Get a Grip came out and they went even higher, which we won't get into that today. But
thank goodness.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's funny, you know, you talked about, you know, In Like a Lamb, Out Like a Lion, and like, there's not that many bands where to start a decade sounding one way and to finish it sounding another.
Right.
I mean, there was a total difference.
Yeah. I don't know, man. It's like you start out at the beginning of the 80s, it's almost, between the end of the 70s and the beginning of the 80s, it's almost like Aerosmith's blackout era.
Oh, totally.
But this episode added a unique perspective because you've seen how the band started out so low.
Very low.
And then, you know, found their way back to success.
Damn.
And by 1990...
They're the biggest band in the world.
Top of the fucking world.
Yeah. You couldn't escape them. They were everywhere. They were just... And like as big as Guns, and we remember Guns N' Roses being at that time, Aerosmith was every bit as big, maybe bigger.
That was something else I thought was kind of funny. So after Permanent Vacation, they're all cleaned up. They're off drugs, right?
Mm-hmm.
They send them out on tour with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, great idea. We're going to put you guys to the test.
That's right. Yeah. I just, when you were talking about their guru, I was thinking, I think you guys are ready. but I don't know. There's only one way to find out for sure. You're going on tour with Guns N' Roses, and you're not going to do drugs with them.
That's brutal.
That is brutal.
Yeah. The ultimate trial by fire.
Yeah. If your sobriety can survive that, you're good.
Yeah.
You are golden.
But yeah, so you were already a fan, so you didn't really enjoy the change.
I had aunts and uncles that had the older stuff.
Were they like, what the fuck?
I had the cassette tape of Aerosmith's Greatest Hits, the one with the red cover with half.
Oh, I was going to mention that. That came out in 1980.
Yeah.
And it didn't do jack shit on the charts, but then by the end of the decade, it had sold fucking millions.
Right.
I owned it.
Because the Aerosmith
Because everyone
fans
got into them.
They're thinking this is a new band.
Yeah.
That goes back to, oh, well, I want to check out their other greatest
hits. Oh, I was one of those people.
And I was one of them, too. Mm-hmm. And that was my Aerosmith, was that cassette tape.
I wore that fucking cassette
Me
out.
Me, too.
Yeah.
I didn't want to listen to this stuff. I wanted to listen to that.
Well, they're also like I was with Kiss. It was like, because I was, like I said, at the time I was getting into them, it was all new to me.
Right.
So I was like, oh, this is great. And then I'm like, oh, there's all this other stuff. And right. then I'm like, wow, this is even better.
And then you get to go back and discover stuff like Rockin' a Hard Place and Done with Mirrors. And to you, it's a new album.
Absolutely.
To me, it was a new album.
It was a great time to be a rock and roll fan.
Definitely.
You know, I know some of the older guys say, oh, I was there in the 70s to see bands, and that's great too. But it was every bit as cool to be a fan in the 80s. And get into that stuff.
I guess, this was pretty cool today.
Yeah.
It was fun to look at this era of Aerosmith because I think it's often overlooked. Everybody looks at once they were huge again or once they were huge in the 70s at one time. Mm-hmm. And this little period in here, this decade, is kind of overlooked. And so it was fun to shine some light on that today.
I think that our picks are some of the best stuff you'll find from that era. So I'm assuming some of you guys may have not even given a shot to some of these records because you've heard the singles a million times. So maybe you picked up something new that you like. Obviously, we want to hear from you. So go on the Facebook page in the comments section for this post and list what are your top five Aerosmith songs of the 80s. It'd be interesting to see what you guys say.
Or maybe take these four albums and put them in order, 1, 2, 3 through 4, and let us know how you rank them. I know I definitely go Done with Mirrors, Rockin' a Hard Place, Permanent Vacation, and lastly, Pump.
I think our five picks together would make one hell of an album.
I would think so, too. I think that's exactly what we did here.
The Lost Aerosmith
album. Yeah, we just brought you the best of the 80s from Aerosmith.
On one record.
That's exactly what we intended to do. Talk to Cobras and Fire, and I am required to say that right now, time is running out in 2019 to help Wikipedia. They're a nonprofit, and they don't have salespeople. They depend on donations, and if you could only give $2.75, the price of your Wednesday coffee, Wikipedia could keep thriving. Thank you.
Oh, wow.
It's a little public service announcement right now.
Well,
Wikipedia is on their seasonal pledge drive, and so since we lean on Wikipedia so
we owe them a lot more than $2.75. We should pony up a lot more than that.
Damn it all. Sometimes Wikipedia really is the best source.
It is the best source.
I tried to look up some Aerosmith stuff, and it's like, it ain't nearly as good as what Wikipedia's got. So
I was going to go to the library and go through microfiche, but I decided, fuck it. I'll just go to Wikipedia.
Chris told me last weekend we were doing this show and I didn't have the time to reread the book. So
yeah,
we got it. We can only do what we can do, and we don't always have an expert on hand. I kind of wish we had an expert today to really give us the in-depth details. But today we just wanted to concentrate on the music and how it affected us at the time and in retrospect. And I think we did that.
So I'll play out with our last song, a little bit of information on this song. This is the other of the two good songs from this record, or two great songs from this record. This song is called F-I-N-E, which stands for Fucked Up, Insecure, Neurotic, and Emotional.
Okay.
And that was what this song was what the band wanted. This title was what the band wanted to call the record. And John Kolodner, who was the A&R guy that was kind of like, he looked like John Lennon or Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
He's like, fuck no, you're not going to do that. So, because he was all about protecting their image.
We are trying to position you to skyrocket your ass to the moon.
Yeah.
You will not sabotage this.
So they were wanting to name the album Fine, but they didn't do it. And
you will play the songs we tell you to play. We will bring them to you, written by other artists. You will play them. You will do what we tell you to do exactly, and you will be the greatest stars of the 90s.
But the lyrics on this are all Steven Tyler, with great lines like, she's got the Cracker Jack, but all I want's the prize. Which is pure Steven Tyler, which is what I love about the guy.
Oh, man. Such a time capsule.
So here is F-I-N-E from Pump, and we'll see you next week.
See ya.
This is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune in to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.